So we finished the normal, what we want to say, of course, this is, or maybe I switch first. Instead of doing the prebiotic evolution, maybe I should do first the chapter on macro ecology. That's, so I switch order. Macroecology. So this is to give a hint about the very big field of ecology. So ecology and evolution is not the same, but it's closely related. And in ecology, you are dealing with a situation like you have it in ecology of many species, or at least more than one species. For example, you have at the lowest level, you have so here you have the predators, and here below you have the people, plant, herbivores, so plant-eating animals, and below there you have plants. So you have a food chain, so you have herbivores, and so on. And you have a complicated interaction. You typically look at stability issues, and this is a very large field, very interesting. So typically, you have equation of motion describing increase in population due to reproduction, decrease in population because you are either eaten or you have constraints because of finite support, and so on. And I just we will study one very nice example of that. But just before we do that, as a general remark, also of this. So ecology in general can be very in detailed. Macroecology deals with the overall picture. For example, a typical question of macroecology, why is the world green? And this might be an astonishing question at the moment, because you say plants are green. Now the issue is here, why do we have, let's say in Europe or in the rainforest, so many trees which have leaves? Why are not they all eaten? So if you have herbivores and plants, why are not there more herbivores which eat up the plants so much that essentially, you would think, oh, if I have a patch, here I have trees and forest, and here it's green, but the other one is just eaten up and has to regrow. And here you have patches of plants, and here the animals have eaten everything up. So the green world hypothesis is, it's astonishing that if you, for example, go to the normal German forest, it's mostly green. You don't see 20% of the forest or 30% of the trees being eaten by some animals. So it's a waste of biomass. Obviously, it's a huge waste of biomass which could be used. And actually, people are complaining if there are some little insects starting to eat, but that's, of course, would be normal. And so these are typical questions of macroecology. Why is the world green and not just more eaten? And for example, you can make experiments. And so, for example, one of the hypotheses is that the reason why the world is green is there are the predators which keeps the population of herbivores substantially below the carrying capacity of the plants. So without predators, you would have so many herbivores that they would eat up the plants until there's a carrying capacity. But the predators retain then at a substantially lower level. And that's why you have green world. And for example, then, but this is very controversial, but for example, people try to make giving experimental support. For example, there is a famous study somewhere in Middle America, I guess. There was a flooding, so you have a river, and it was a very large flooding, and there were patches of islands, and there are some islands where there were only plants and herbivores, and on some islands there also remained some predators. And then the people looked at that, and at that time they would claim they have evidence that on the islands with predators it would be much more greener. So if you just take pictures and you count the number of trees or whatever, you would have much a substantially larger biomass in the plants than in islands close by where there would be no predators left because of the flooding. It was a random process. For example, these are typical questions of macroecology, which are of course pretty controversial and very difficult to, make field studies. We are discussing a very concrete issue on macroecology. We're going through the theory, a very simple theory. And the reason is you can really make experiments. And the number we want to study is the distribution. So the basic experiment is the following. You go to the forest, for example, to the rainforest. You do a patch, let's say, of 1 kilometer times 1 kilometer, and you count the number of trees, and you count the number of trees of different species. For example, this species would have a count of 4, this species would have a count of 2, and this species would also have a count of 2. So you count all different trees which you see, which you can do on a patch, and you do and you count how many times a certain individuals of a certain species are there. So it's for trees where you can do that. And then you do a distribution function of abundance distribution function. So let's say you have 10 or 100 or 1,000 individuals of a certain species, and then you have many species in the rainforest. You couldn't do that here in Germany. And then you have a certain distribution function. That means the how many species do you find which have 100 individuals? How many species do you find which have only have 10 individuals there, or 1,000? So there will be somewhere a maximum. So you have a certain distribution function. And the question is, can you explain that? So can you make a theory explaining this distribution function? And this is a well-defined quantity which you can measure. And the interesting point is you cannot only do that with trees, but you can also do the same with a patch of, let's say, 10 centimeters times 10 centimeters of earth. And then you don't count trees, but then you count all the little animals which are living there. And then you get a similar distribution function. So the idea is of universality. So it doesn't really matter whether you're counting trees in 1 kilometer times 1 kilometer, or you're taking a path of earth and you dig there and you look how many bugs and worms and whatever is living there, and then you do the same abundance distribution function. Of course, it will be a little bit different, but whether there's some universality. And then that is typically macroecology of the very big level. And since you are looking at a very big level, you can forget about the details, hopefully, and make a more general theory. So let's do an example of that. And that is what you're calling, going to discuss, is the neuter theory of macroecology. And it's called neuter because we will forget about all these details of the species. So normally, in most ecological consideration, you think, well, I consider the difference between between jaguar and puma, and I consider the difference between this kind of tree and that kind of tree, and everything matters. And here, forget about all the differences and just do a statistical evaluation. And so then the basic assumption is, well, the basic quantity we want to consider is the probability px of t over et of observing x individuals of a given species at time t. So we focus on the different species, of course, interacting with all other kind of species, the number of individuals are x, and that can change in time. So how can it change in time? Well, this is the usual master equation, d by dt, rho x of t, is what you get minus what you lose. So that is the difference. Is b, x minus 1, p x minus 1 t, that is when there are birth processes. So when there's birth processes and had before one individual less, I get one in addition, plus the death process, x plus 1. So if the population was before, because we have a continuous time before larger and somebody dies, I go to my population size, minus what I'm losing because of these processes, minus b of x plus d of x, p of x and t. So if I have birth or death processes at the present stage, I always change my population, so I'm losing because the number of individuals will change this time. Okay, so this is not yet said anything because this is so basic that this is just common sense. And everything, the full information or the full physics or biology goes into assuming what are these birth and death processes. So B stands for birth and D for death. And so, we can also do it here. We write that, now that is the crucial point, B of x equals B0 tilde plus B1 tilde x. And the same here, dx equals d0 tilde plus d1 tilde x. So that is now the key point. We have two contributions. V0 tilde and d0 tilde are intensive. And the terms proportional d1 and b1 tilde are extensive. So normally, you would assume only these terms because you say the number of individuals dying is proportional to the population size and the number of offsprings is proportional to the population size. That's fine. So the extensive one are just the normal internal processes, reproduction processes, and death. But this can also be if you have immigration or migration in general. So if there's a certain number of individuals coming to your patch from the outsides, so this is would be a D0, and going away, D0 tilde, that is not necessarily proportional to the number of individuals, but at the border on the geological constraints, what is possible to enter here. So if I make it larger and larger and larger here, it doesn't really mean that I have more immigration at the border. It can be, but normally that is not the case. So if I consider also migration, now that is now where ecology comes in, and I believe that migration is an important factor together with my normal birth and death processes, then I have these kind of equations. Okay, and that is easily to be solved. And the reason, one of the other reasons I'm doing that is not just because it's interesting, but it's an example how we can go quite generally, and not only in this example, but in many other ways, from this equation of motion, the master equation, to a Fokker-Planck equation. This is a general procedure which we do here for this kind of, here in the macroecology, but it's pretty generally valid. And the idea is one does a Taylor expansion. So now we look. So for example, if we take two terms, So if you take these two terms together, so we have here a dx plus 1, px plus 1 at time t minus dx px from t. This I can write in the following way. This is in the following way. So I'm having saying, so this is maybe I write first the other side and then so I do a Taylor expansion. Let me just So this is proportional to d to the dx. Dx p of x plus 1/2 d by dx squared d of x p of x and so on. So if we let's do that. So if we write this this derivative here, this is d of x plus 1 p of x plus 1 minus d of x p of x divided by delta x, which is 1. And this is higher order terms. And something is wrong here. Wait a minute. Something is wrong. It's d of x. Wait a minute. No, I think, sorry, I do the wrong argument here. Sorry. So I consider, let me do it a slightly different way. So let's consider that d of x, p of x is a function of f of x. Then we have f of x plus 1 is approximately f of x plus d by dx f of x times 1, which is delta x, plus 1/2 d by dx squared f of x times 1 squared plus and so on. So that is a Taylor expansion. And so if I put this one on the other side, then this here is the Taylor expansion to second order. Yeah? Clear? So this is very generic, because in any master equation, because of particle number conservation or individual conservation, what I'm losing on one side, I'm gaining on the other side. I always have these kind of differences. So that's why in nearly for all master equations, I can use this Taylor expansion. Okay. If I do that, then I can write my master equation in the following way. D by dt of p, let's say putting the x now here in the functional in the bracket equals d by dx dx minus bx p of x and t plus 1/2 d by dx squared dx plus bx rho of x and t. So we have seen this here, that this is true. Here we get a minus sign. Why do we get a minus sign? Because we have minus x. So then if we have a minus sign, this changes here sign, and that is why we have a minus sign here. And now we just use our expression here, and then we see that we have something which is very similar to the Fokker-Planck equation. Well, anyhow, this expression is already the Fokker-Planck expression. Only when we introduce our when our our intensive and extensive quantities, we have expression for the diffusion constant and the drift velocity. So this is then d by dx of x divided by tau minus b, which will be a rewriting of this constant, which I'm just giving you now, p of x at t, plus d d by dx squared x p of x at t, where we have used a certain expression, namely where our d here is nothing else than b1 tilde plus d1 tilde divided by 2. Because I have the x here, so I have this one and this one, where I assumed also, this is what we are going to assume here, that b0 tilde plus d1 tilde equal 0, and b0 tilde larger than 0. I have a tilde missing here. Just coming to that shortly, that is why this term is vanishing here. It's not here. I assume then that b, that this isn't just b, b here is then just b0 tilde minus d0 tilde, and that is positive. And tau is then what is left, let us say 1 over tau is just what is left, d1 tilde minus b1 tilde. It's just a rewriting of what I had before. So, okay. So we know from our Fokker-Planck equation that this here is a diffusion process, and this here is a drift process. So I do a random walk through the population space. The population number can either drift with this kind of drift velocity, which can be either positive or negative, and then I have a diffusion process through stochastic processes. This diffusion process is proportional to the birth and the extensive birth and death processes. And the drift has a component which is also here of the net birth and death or minus birth and proportional intensive quantity proportional to the net immigration. Because this is the difference here, B is the difference, so this is a net immigration. So we can solve this equation, this Fokker-Planck equation. As you see, this is not really anything deep in the theory. It is just that you think what kind of fundamental processes you have, but the equations are standard equations which you have seen many, many times. It is just thinking somewhat deeply and making use of your ecological knowledge to interpret and set your parameters. So before we solve that, let's make an example. First, consider an example, a special case, a very special case. This is what we always do. We want to get a feeling of what an equation is doing. We're taking a special case, and one of the possibilities, B equals 0 equals D. And then we have, if we look here, D equals 0, then I can take the derivative, and B is also equal to 0, so I have only tau, which is a relaxation, which we will now see. We have tau rho dot equals P plus X P prime. Because if it takes the derivative here, everything else is 0, I can it here, then I have power, or I can take it here, then I have X P prime. And this has a simple solution, namely P is proportional to e to the minus t over tau, x to the power beta, so if we solve that, maybe just do the solution here. So if I take the time derivative, P dot equals minus 1 over tau P, and P prime equals beta P divided by X. And if I plot that in, then I have here P dot, so I have minus P, so minus 1 equals 1 plus beta. So, something wrong here? Minus tau, something is wrong. Tau. Minus T. I think I have to put here a general T, because I can have the solution T equals tau, but I don't really need that. I have then here minus tau over T. I have two unknowns here. So I have a class of solutions where this is obviously has to fulfill, and for every beta and T fulfilling this solution, this is fulfilling this condition, this is the solution. And so what does it mean is, I have obviously, so the question is, what is T? T equals there's something with a minus sign. T equals minus tau 1 plus beta. Now, in order for this one here to be normalizable, so that P of T and X dx is smaller than infinity, we need to have that beta is smaller than minus 1. Because otherwise, this is not a normalizable contribution. If beta is smaller than minus 1, this 1 plus beta is negative, so that means this is positive. So for all betas which make a normalizable distribution, I have that T is positive. And if T is positive, means I have here a relaxation time. The population decays. So that's why T is relaxation time, and this is induced by my tau. Only if I have a finite tau, my relaxation time is finite. If tau is zero, my relaxation time is zero. So tau is a relaxation process. And now we are looking, this was as a function of time. Now we are looking at the steady state solution. Namely, that d by dt of p of x and t equals 0. And that means I have just these two here. And now I can integrate that because my solution is, well, we will just write it down, p0 of x, because it doesn't depend anymore on time, equals a times x to the power b over d minus 1, e to the minus x divided by d times tau. This looks pretty complicated, but it's actually pretty easy to solve. We can show that in two steps. The first step is to look here at the one where the gradient is zero. So since this is the derivative, we look at that this one is this one, apart from this differential equation. So we can take one gradient away. So zero equals x over tau minus b, p0 of x. If we have no steady state gradient, plus d by dx, x p0 of x. Because if you remember of our continuity equation, that rho dot equals minus the gradient of the current. And in the equilibrium, I don't have any current. So I can set the current to 0 here. And that is just taking one derivative away. And now it's very easy to show that this is a solution because I just have to plug that one in. And I find that it's not very difficult. I just leave the step. So how does the solution look like? Well, the solution as a function of x increases here like a power, so like x to the power b divided by d minus 1. But it goes down exponentially for large x with e to the minus x divided by d times tau. So we have typically a power law here and an exponential decrease for a large number large number of individuals. So this is an extremely simple process. And the nice thing is that if you look, this is a given here, at the actual data, that the actual data is pretty well described by such kind of curve. And this is non-trivial because naively you might think, why don't I have more? Why I have so few species with very large population, with very small population size? But you could think, well, If I have a small population size, I can have many species. Of course, here it has to go down, because if I have a large number of individuals and I have a finite terrain, there has to go down the number of species. But here, it could also have gone up. And so this is a non-trivial result that with this kind of balance between immigration and internal processes, I can describe that. Because essentially, what happens is that species which have a very low number of individuals tend stochastically to also die out because of emigration or because of death processes. Now this, you might then think, well, this is a very specific model. What is kind of universality here? But then you can say, well, if we know the essential of the model, of the what is going on, we can maybe describe it also in a different way. And for example, you could consider the following model, a microscopic model. And if you are describing the correct mechanism, then a similar outcome should be with a different kind of model if the mechanisms are the correct ones. And for example, what you could do is to consider a population of S species. So this is a microscopic model. You consider every species. And overall, N individuals, the entries. In this case, if one population, one species has more, so more trees of one kind, there will be less trees of another kind. Then, so you have this species 1, species 2, species 3, species 4, and they are interacting. Because now you consider a microscopic model of an ecosystem. And these interactions are, of course, random. Well, actually, we consider all interactions. So what happens afterwards is random. And for every pair, I have the probability rho, this is the probability rho, one species dominates the other. And 1 minus p, it is neutral. So what I'm saying is, we consider all interactions pairwise in the ecosystem. And so, and then we do a dominance. So for example, if one tree dominates the other one, means, for example, it can grow faster, takes away the light, and then this tree, the other tree, might have a disadvantage. If they are neutral, which is a vast majority, rho is a small number, if it's a neutral relationship, they don't harm each other. So the growth and the death of one species is not affected by the other species. So with a small probability, rho, I have a dominance relation, which is pretty realistic. Okay, so these are my deaths. I will explain it in detail now. My deaths and my birth processes. But then, of course, that is not enough, because I also need the equivalence of the migration. So the dynamics goes in the following way. So we have two variables, rho, dominance probability, and we will have another variable, mu, which I define now. So at every time step, we do the following. Select S, S prime randomly. So you take two species. Then we have a stochastic process. Stochastic process. With probability mu, one of the species is plus one, so n of s goes to n of s plus one, and n of s prime goes of n of s prime minus one, where it is random whether it's n on s prime which is increased. So the number of individuals remains the same. And second, which is competition. This is the probability 1 minus mu. You do the following. N of the inferior one goes to n inferior minus one, on n the superior species goes to n superior plus one, and nothing if the relation is neutral. Okay, so it's very simple. So you take two random species. You look whether the relation is neutral or whether one species dominates the other one. In any case, you draw a dice, and if the probability is smaller than mu, you just do a random exchange of the number of individuals, which is a stochastic process. So you really don't say, just stochastic, anyone can increase the number, the other one has to give one up. But if there is a competition, so if one of the species is superior to the other one, so if the relation is not neutral, then with the probability 1 minus mu, the inferior one loses one and the superior one gets one individual. Now, this is more like than a drift process, because this is a deterministic process. Of course, it doesn't always occur, but it gives you a clear hierarchy. And so here you also have two essential ingredients, namely competition and stochasticity, which you also had in the previous model. The stochastic process was there the immigration. It was random whether you would immigrate or emigrate. And the competition was the birth rate, which was deterministic, proportional to x and b of the individual species. You can see you have a very different model because it's now microscopic. You consider the number of every species. You can let it run on the computer. It's very simple to run it on the computer. And if the parameters are right, you will find a very similar curves. Not exactly, of course, the same, but very similar one. So it doesn't tell you that either this or this model is correct or incorrect, but that if you have the correct ingredients, you have different ways to describe the same processes. But if the basic ingredients are correct, and that is the core of modeling something, then you get a similar result. And so the nice thing is, it's very universal, and as I said, if you do a patch of 10 centimeters by 10 centimeters and counting the animals there, you will find a very similar curve, not identical, so shown that the basic processes are really very universal. So this is a typical example of macroecology and arguments. And yeah. So I think I will skip the chapter about prebiotic evolution since it's pretty similar like normal evolution, even so it is more generic. And let's go and do the relation to game theory. So evolution, so if we go then one step further, evolution and game theory are pretty much related. And the reason is very similar. So in mathematical game theory, which is extremely popular in the economics, so essentially our economical system is considered as a game where everybody tries to maximize its own utility function. Not all, but many evolutionary processes you can cast into the language of game theory, saying that the agents, which are there, the genes, want to maximize their own utility function, namely the number of offsprings. And game theory is especially then important if you consider social interactions. For example, if you want to study how a certain social behavior has been selected positively or negatively during evolutionary processes, so you can make models and see where now you have to model not an abstract identity, but a society of agents which compete with each other, but interacting with each other. So this is extremely popular in the realm of evolution of social behavior. And so this is, of course, closely related to co-evolution, because a species or an allele is not independent of each other, but depends on the social or ecological context. So we have already seen one very central, very, very central Erkenntnis theorem of coevolution, which is a notion of punctuated equilibrium. Namely, that evolutionary processes are quasi-stationary with very rapid changes in between, so punctuated by rapid changes. I'm not going to repeat that. There are many, many evolutionary processes. I'm just giving you one example, co-evolutionary processes which are famous. One of the probably best known is the red queen phenomena. Which is the following. This is a quote from a children's book where Red Queen says the following sentence. It takes all the running to stay in place. And that is a typical situation for closely related predator prey relationship. So the lion, the gepard becomes faster and faster, the gazelle becomes faster and faster, and it takes all the running to stay in place. Relatively, they don't make progress. Gazelles are eaten as often as 40 million years ago, but they all became faster. There are snakes and tots, the famous example in North America. The tot is poisonous, because snakes eat them, and with all generation over millions or thousands of years, it becomes more and more poisonous. The snake develops more and more resistance, and nowadays the tot is as often eaten by the snake as 1 million years ago, but one has become very poisonous and the other one has become extremely resistant. So it takes all the running just to stay in place. The relative relation often does not change, not always, of course. It can also happen that the snake dies out, and so you don't see them. The snake, which does not do the running, the adapting, dies out. But if it does it all the running, it just stays in place. So that's typical in many evolutionary situations, that the relative rate does not really change, because everything is relative, not absolute. A very famous example is, a very famous hypothesis is that at the Cambrian evolution, explosion, this was about 430 or so million years ago, up to 490 million years, a huge number of species developed, and the evolutionary process was so extremely rapidly that everybody talks about an explosion of species at that time. And one of the hypotheses is, there were quite a few different factors probably, is that the invention of ice at that time, that before, when you were hunting, either you did it chemically by smell, or you just had to, by chance, grab the animal which you would like to hunt. And so the first eyes, which were probably extremely primitive, had a gigantic evolutionary, success, even if they were very, very primitive, because you could hunt seeing something. And then, of course, we had a strong co-evolutionary process was stipulated because everybody preys which could not see and could not move fast enough would disappear. So a very, very strong co-evolutionary avalanche started. So that is one of the hypotheses. It's a little bit controversial. There might be other factors more important. But that one of the factors was that eyes were invented at that time, driving a gigantic co-evolutionary avalanche. Maybe the biggest we have ever seen. And so everybody had to run just to stay in place. But of course, many new species became developed at that time. So what does that have to do with game theory? Well, in game theory, we don't talk about offsprings normally, but about utility. So in game theory, we have the following. The following ingredients. It's all very intuitive. And the first one is utility. So that is something which you can measure, normally in dollar, or I think most game theories measured in dollar, sometimes in euro, sometimes in gold. So whatever it is, you may not always know that, but it's something you're trying to maximize. A scalar function. Scalar quantity to be maximized. And you are happy if you have plenty of this quantity. So normally it's associated with money, but it could also be something abstract like satisfaction, happiness, and stuff like that. In order to do that, you have a strategy which you employ when you encounter other agents. So this is a course of action when encountering other agents. So you don't consider daily survival, that you go to the forest and pick some fruits, but you consider only the social interactions by encountering and interacting with other agents of your own species. And that is already all. And then, since you formulated it mathematically, you can do mathematical game theory, you can prove some theorem, Nash equilibrium, and things like that, which we'll do a little bit. How you do this encounter can be very different. For example, it could be a zero-sum game, but it must not be. That means what you lose, somebody else gains, and vice versa. Gain without loss. So the total quantity in the game remains constant, and you can only gain money if somebody loses money, and vice versa. Not all games are like that. Some games are like that. Then, of course, and now this is important for evolution, the game can be adaptive or not. So this is where evolution comes in. If a game is adaptive, you adapt your strategy. And of course, you adapt your strategy on your successes or failures you have experienced in order to maximize future successes. And so That is where then evolutionary processes come in, saying if every strategy corresponds to a gene, then adapting the strategy means that genes which had a higher success will be more popular or more widespread in the future, and vice versa. So adaptive games are very closely related to evolutionary processes. You can either one agent adapts this strategy, or it's replaced by another agent which has a better strategy, which is the same, just viewed from a different point of view. So once you include this kind of possibilities, game theory becomes an evolutionary process. In standard mathematical game theory, that's normally not done. We just have utility and strategies. But of course, it's an easy step to go to adaptive games. So there are many, many famous games. One of the simplest is Hawk and Doves. So the hawk is aggressive, to say, and the doves peaceful, to say. I guess in nature that is not really the case, but that is idealization of humanity. There's probably nothing to do with nature, but doesn't really matter. And the utility, since you now have four kind of encounters, so a hawk can encounter a dove, a hawk can encounter another hawk, a dove can encounter a hawk. Since you have four kind of encounters, obviously you can write down the outcome of all these four encounters in a matrix, in a 2x2 matrix. And this 2x2 matrix is denoted the utility matrix or the payoff matrix. But you don't need really to do that. You can do that because it's just 2x2. Why not? It's normally A. So A is the utility of hawk. Utility when a dove meets a hawk, or the other way around. A dove hawk, a dove dove. And for this game here, it is specified by something like the following: 1/2 V minus C, V 0 V half, where V and C are positive numbers. And so the reason is extremely simple. So if two peaceful agents meet, everybody gets something, they don't fight, everybody gets half of the prize. So that's why we have. If an hawk meets a dove, the hawk gets everything, the dove gets nothing. So that's why I have a zero here. If the dove meets a hawk, the dove doesn't get anything, the hawk gets anything. But if two hawks meet each other, well, in the end, everybody gets half of it, but they also may fight. They're losing time fighting. Maybe they get injured. So you have some negative payoff, which is C. So they don't get everything because they fight. And so then you can take a look, which is the equilibrium and which is the most successful strategy. And what you then will find that there is a payoff, that's a difference. So for, let's say, this is V and this is C. If if B, what you gain, is larger than what you lose, then yeah, this is, so here you have, yeah, so this is the percentage, yes, percentage of doves. So if C is 0, not the other way around, of hawk, wait a minute. Yeah, of hawks, not of doves. So if you don't lose anything, you can look at the solution. There will be only hawks around. If C is large, so this becomes negative, there will be no hawks and there will be only doves. But nevertheless, this is an, so this is an equilibrium, yeah. And if you start with 0 percentage of, so if you start with a population where there's only doves here, then this population is unstable. There will be, if there's a random hawk, it will multiply until you get to this fixed point here. So this is a standard game with a very standard fixed point. And one denotes a Nash equilibrium, an equilibrium which is stable against changes of strategy. So that is one of the most important notions. So if you have an equilibrium in a game situation, if any of the agents changes equilibrium, its utility, expected utility, goes down. So it's not just an equilibrium because of global processes, but every single agent has no incentive to change his strategy, because any strategy change would give him a lower average utility. And Nash has then proven that certain classes of games have always such kind of equilibrium and other classes of games don't have. And this here, of course, has a Nash equilibrium. The population where you have only doves is also an equilibrium, but not a Nash equilibrium, because if one dove changes strategy and becomes a hawk, it has an advantage, because everybody else is a dove, so it only wins, it never loses something. So the population, it's an unstable fixed point in dynamical system theory, or it's not a Nash equilibrium in game theory. So essentially, a Nash equilibrium is a stable fixed point. So this is all very trivial, and interesting games are then there, and people discuss it for eternity, where there's some internal contradiction. And the most famous game where there's some internal contradiction is the prisoner's dilemma. And there are many variants of that. Without going into the mathematics, its notion is very simple. So you have two prisoners, so two people are arrested. And they have two possibilities to cooperate. Now, cooperation, normally you would think they cooperate with the police, but that's not what meant here is. Cooperate means that the two criminals cooperate with each other. Or the other possibility is to defect, means only act independently, independently of the other person, the other. And now let's say we have the following. Let's say they have stolen something. If they cooperate, means they don't say anything to the police. So both cooperate. They get the utility, which is normally denoted R. R equals 3, for example. Just to give a number. If they both defect, they say, well, they talk to the police and say the other was what he was doing, then they get better because everybody gets a P1 because the police is happy that they cooperate. And now we can have the situation where B, or this is D, C, 1 defects. He is getting T equals 5, and the other one cooperates, and he gets, which is normally denoted by S, equals 0. So if one of the criminals doesn't say anything, shuts his mouth because he wants to be quiet, the other one says, "Oh, I'm telling you exactly how it's going on. I was just being convinced by my colleague to do that. I'm actually not really did anything." Then he may get freedom. Not any prison at all. He gets a maximum reward, while your teammate is getting into prison for a long time, so he gets nothing. And so why is there internal contradiction? Because if both cooperates, the total utility is 2 times 3 equals 6, and 6 is higher than the total utility in this case, 5. And so this is a typical game, which where if everybody is social and cooperates, it's best for society. But for the individual, it's best not to cooperate if the other individual is socially motivated and cooperates. So that is a typical case where the Nash equilibrium is where if you do it for a large population, a certain percentage of defectors and cooperators is not the state with the highest utility for everybody. Because if this is not a Nash equilibrium, if everybody cooperates, this is also a fixed point, but not a Nash equilibrium, because if everybody cooperates, it's for you worthwhile to change your strategy into defect, because you get more. So then the maximum utility state is not a Nash equilibrium. And so then the question is, how generic is that? This is, of course, but we might think that in many economic processes, this is the case, that most economic processes probably fall into this class. That's why we need a state and laws. We wouldn't need a state and we wouldn't need any law if economic processes would be the other way around, namely that the best for society is if everybody is doing the best for himself. So the principle of capitalism is that the economic games is not of this kind. But we see there are counterexamples. There exist games where the best of society is not if everybody maximizes his own utility function. And so that's why people say you need better social capitalism instead of straightforward capitalism, because we believe that market economy is not the game of where the cooperating behavior is a Nash equilibrium. Of course, since we don't know the law of economics so well, people can discuss about it for a long time, but essentially that is the reason why we have a state and we have laws, because we wouldn't need that if it would be the best for everybody if you do maximize your own profit all the time. And so you have then a mathematical well-defined framework to talk about this issue. And in economics, and there have been many Nobel Prizes in economics discussing exactly in these kind of terms. For example, they're always talking about utility functions. For example, and also in things, circumstances you might think has nothing to do with utility, for example, the birth rate. So a famous theory in macroeconomics is that in a country where the general level of education is small, you get your maximum utility, namely the maximum support when you're older, if you invest in many children. But if the general level of education is higher, your utility function is maximized if you invest into few children and you invest into their education. Because then your return on investment when you're older is higher. And that is explaining the drop in birth rate as soon as your level of education goes up. So these are kind of arguments which are then standard in a theory of economics. So going back to the system of complex systems, the theory of complex systems, you can, of course, also put these games onto a lattice. So this is normally considered randomly. So the agents don't have any spatial position. They interact randomly. But you can also put them, let's say, on a lattice or on a cellular automata and saying every cell is an agent and the agent interacts with a finite number of neighbors. And then you get games on a lattice, and then you get also pattern formation, things like that. So if you put games on a lattice and they are adaptive, they change the strategy, of course you get colonies of cooperating and defecting. So often you get, this is for example the prisoner's dilemma on a lattice, what you get is large patches of cooperating agents interceded with defectors like that. That is very, very intuitive because the defectors intrude into this, because they intrude us into these patches of cooperating agents. And so this is, of course, if you have some population in real space or just for theoretical reasons, or you have population of animals interacting in a geological environment. And then you can study all that we studied here, pattern formation, emergence, and things like that. So next Tuesday we have our talks, and who's talking? Yes. You are talking. And on Wednesday, some more. Yeah. So then see you on Thursday and Wednesday.